This is Sharon Jacobs for Energy Trade-Offs, and I'm speaking today with Professor KK Duvivier, who's professor at Denver University's Sturm College of Law, right down the road from me. I'm here in Boulder, Colorado. And we're going to be talking today about the current role of wind in the energy transition, but more specifically about some of the trade-offs and tensions affecting wind siting. So as we all know, wind power is a clean source of renewable energy, and it provided over 7% of U.S. electricity needs last year. So there's about 100 gigawatts of wind energy capacity in the U.S. right now, but the potential is much, much greater. So I want to focus our conversation today on two areas, paralleling the topics of two of your recent articles on wind turbine siting. And first, I want to talk about some of the trade-offs or tensions between siting wind turbines in the optimal location from an engineering perspective, and minimizing local opposition and legal hurdles at the same time. And then we'll turn to some of the trade-offs between, say, a desire to site as many wind turbines as possible in a given area, but also ensuring that those turbines produce energy as efficiently as possible and with minimal wear and tear. So maybe first we could turn to the question of optimal wind siting from an engineering perspective. Where should we be siting wind turbines if our only concern, or maybe our primary concern, is to generate wind energy as efficiently as possible?
Thanks, Sharon. The best place to site would be where is there the best wind resource. And the problem for first generation turbines was that the best wind resources were located in sparsely populated flyover states like the Dakotas and Nebraska and Kansas and the Panhandle of Texas. So electricity was not being generated close to where it's being consumed. Building high power transmission lines to far off load centers was expensive and complicated because they crossed jurisdiction and it was unclear who would pay. So, you know, I think terrestrial wind has been cited where it makes the most sense, but it doesn't make the most sense as far as our needs.
And what kind of regulatory regimes do wind developers have to deal with? And, you know, maybe it's different, right, if they want to site on private land or federal land, but what are the different legal regimes we're talking about here?
Well, the states have been reluctant to enact statewide wind siting regimes. So generally, the regulation falls to local governments for private land development. So counties, cities, townships, and they often, you know, have land use regulations that don't really relate to wind. And so it doesn't work particularly well. One example that I think is interesting is, you know, having a fence to cover any industrial site. Well, you don't want to have a build 100 foot, a 200 foot tall fence to block a wind turbine. That doesn't really make sense. Wind development on federal lands is regulated by the particular federal agency that controls those lands, such as BLM or the Forest Service, or other federal agencies that have some jurisdiction, such as U.S. Fish and Wildlife, to regulate the impact of the turbine blades on birds. But despite the federal government's efforts to promote wind projects, only about 5% of the total producing utility-scale wind energy capacity on federal lands has yet been developed.
And let me start with the local piece of it. So you point out that if cities and towns of authority, if they have the authority to ban wind development, then we can quickly go from, I'm going to use some acronyms here that you use in your piece, NIMBY, right, which is not in my backyard, to NOPE, which is not on planet Earth. So in other words, you know, from some communities saying we don't want the wind turbines here to there really being no place that these wind installations can install their turbines, as you say happened in New York State in the early 2000s. So why is that? Why, if we give local governments this authority to ban wind development, are we going to go quickly to a place perhaps where we can't site them anywhere?
Well, I'm just going to talk about two specifically. One is, you know, a wind turbine is an industrial site, essentially a 300-foot tower. You don't want that in your backyard, so there are aesthetic impacts. And even if it's in your ocean view, it's disturbing for some people. Some of us like it as kinesthetic art, but others don't. But I think the issue that sort of still bugs me is the jury's out on the impact of the low-frequency noise that wind generators emit. It's quieter than a lot of noises that are covered by city noise codes. It's usually it's about 43 decibels, which is an average air conditioner, which is about 50. Refrigerators run around 40. So it doesn't seem that loud to us city folks, but if you're in a very quiet areas, so a lot of these are out in the country, you hear it, and it's sort of an unrelenting, low pulsing that if you don't have the background noise, there's still some calls for additional study and regulation of that. Two other issues specifically are, you know, endangered species, whether there are in the building of the turbines, then you could displace, you know, wildlife. And there is an issue with the turbines killing bald and golden eagles. Golden eagles are actually more threatened than the bald eagles by wind turbines. Again, they don't kill as many birds as cats kill, but still, probably they kill more eagles than cats kill. And then there are some concerns about building them in areas where there are archaeological sites and things like that that people are disturbed about. So again, I don't think those are local community concerns per se, but they are concerns, and they've definitely impacted the development of federal lands.
So you make some observations in one of your pieces about the right level to regulate wind turbine siting, or at least some thoughts about the advantages and disadvantages of state versus local. Where do you come out on this? If we want to honor local and other concerns about turbine siting, but also ensure that some turbines get sited, what's the right level of government to regulate?
Well, I have to say that I'm coming from a position of being a city attorney at one point too, so I'm very much into local control and local concerns, but I try to make the point that at least in Colorado and many other of these states, you have a statewide commission that regulates oil and gas, so they have an advantage of having uniform regulations county by county that renewables don't have, and renewables have had to buck up against this. So I do tend to fall down the side, I guess, of statewide siting, because I think that's at least more fair and leveling the playing field.
And we've, of course, you mentioned Colorado, we've been wrestling with this issue on the oil and gas side in Colorado. How much local control should governments have over the siting of hydraulic fracturing facilities, for example? And we had a new piece of legislation passed here recently that tries to move some of that, or ensure that a lot of that authority stays at the state level, but still allowing local governments an opportunity to participate. So, you know, one of the things I noticed in your piece is that you suggest that even in these statewide regimes, or we have states preempting local regulation of siting, there should be some mechanisms, right, for participation. And I assume the city attorney, former city attorney in you, shares those inclinations.
Absolutely. I think, you know, in advocating for statewide siting, and as you mentioned in the NIMBY to NOTE article, I discuss a case where, you know, one county approved, because wind sites often cross more than one jurisdiction, so they actually have more problems than maybe an oil and gas development or other kind of power plant. And so one township agreed to develop, and then the other one didn't, and then by the time the developer had tried to, you know, sue and allow the development in the other county, then they had had a turnover in the town councils on the ones that originally approved it. So it makes it a nightmare for renewables. But that isn't to say that I wouldn't want local input on these things. I think another reason, though, to have statewide siting, well, two, I'll say. One is that they don't often have the resources to have the expertise that you could have on a statewide level with respect to what's an appropriate siting. And then the other one is that, you know, local politicians can be more swayed one way or the other, I suppose, by the industry interests. So you're not always getting the people represented or health issues addressed in those situations.
Wind developers, of course, want to space their turbines more carefully on their own land, but there are also these conflicts that arise between adjacent wind plants, right? So different developers or different facilities within the same geographic area, larger geographic area. So how might one plant go about protecting its own project from another project?
Yeah, and the reality from my research is there really are very few protections. The wind industry has developed in a Wild West claim jumper type of environment where companies don't want others to even know what they're doing. and they intentionally tie up land around a critical transmission connection to prevent others from being able to compete or develop without working with them. And sadly, this competition can cause dire circumstances. The FAA, for instance, requires lighting and marking for a tower that's over 200 feet. And a gray unmarked MET, they call it MET tower, MET meteorological tower, can be camouflaged in farm country. So multiple pilots have died flying into them. In 2014, there was a lawsuit. The family of a pilot received $6.7 million in a wrongful death settlement. The pilot was killed when he struck an unmarked 60-meter MET tower, which was, he was trying to plant with his plane. And the wind developer's tower was just 3 feet under the FAA 200-foot requirement. And the way they managed to keep it under that, so they didn't have to mark it, so none of the competition could see it, was by not including the manufacturer's lightning rod. And if that lightning rod had been installed, it would have been 203 feet and required the lighting and the warning signs. And so they did that shortcut in order for other people not to see. So it's gotten pretty cutthroat in that way.
Wow. That's obviously a human tragedy. In terms of the economic impacts or the efficiency impacts, with all this land being bought up and claims being staked, where does the moat come in? How could that be an effective strategy for a developer to try to protect their own turbines and ensure that they have enough wind without the wake or the turbulence for their own turbines?
Right. So when in my moat mentality article, I outline how common law options have not really been helpful for protecting one wind farm against another. For instance, if you try to sue for negligence, there's a problem because you need to have an industry standard to determine whether the other party impacted you. And there's really in the United States, you have trouble with the injury element of negligence because in the United States, there's no recognized property interest in wind. And that seems to be a little different in Europe. If you tried to apply, sue for nuisance, that's also problematic because it's hard to show that it was an unreasonable or unwarranted use of their land to build turbines on their own property. And so because the common law has not provided protection, the norm seems to be creating these buffer zones or rings of undeveloped land around a project, not like a moat, to protect a castle from neighboring wind developments. And these moats can protect your investment on your property, but they render large areas that could be generating electricity into unproductive waste zones.
Right. This is making me think of Spindletop, Texas, right? When Texas transformed into a major producer and everyone, was looking out for themselves and sank their oil wells right next to each other. And what came out of that eventually, right, was that we got statutes and we got regulations that prevented waste, et cetera. So is there anything like that on the horizon? Do we have any statutes that are regulating waking and the placement of wind turbines?
Yes, I often use a picture of Spindletop in my lectures of this, showing the same thing where they jam the turbines in the same way they used to jam those rigs in. And that in oil and gas, another one of my articles, I talk about some of the history of pooling and unitization. And ultimately, I think something like that would be helpful in the wind context. So far, because wind is invisible and oil you can see and you can see it spilled on the ground, people aren't visually seeing the waste the way they did in the oil country. And so only one state is even administratively addressed impacts from one site to another. That's Minnesota. And mostly they're doing setbacks. So that's the main kind of regulation that anybody's done. And in the UK, which is the world's leader in offshore wind development, they have a mandatory 5-kilometer setback for each of their leases. So they create these moats, essentially, these rings around their projects to try to protect other projects. But I have some issues with setbacks like that, just setbacks. First, they're over-inclusive because there might be conditions where you could have a closer spacing and the rule of thumb is too far back, you're really wasting some energy. The second one is they're under-inclusive because there are situations, and that's in my Nature Energy article, some of the atmospheric scientist data, of that, you know, a 5-kilometer setback is not going to be enough in some situations. So having it be rigid is not really going to help. And finally, having that, you know, determined or rigid setback prevents future wind development. It may not make sense if you're not sure what's going to happen in the future. So requiring this ring around it is not necessarily a good idea. So what I'm recommending more is, I think having the setbacks is a first step that I do agree with, because it does at least give the downwind developers some leverage. The Nature Energy article, we had an economist on that team too that was calculating that the losses of an existing downwind wind farm were between $1 million and maybe $3 or $4 million a year because someone built a wind farm upstream. And so at least if you had setbacks or codified rules, then you could have some basis for nuisance legislation. And that would be helpful as a starting point. I, though, recommend something more like site-specific planning, which would be more like pooling or unitization in oil and gas, and requiring cooperation with neighboring projects. I know that's contrary to the currently highly competitive culture of the wind industry, but I think that that's something that we should definitely try to do, because that would optimize the wind resource across adjacent areas and projects.
Right. Is that something that we've seen anywhere? Is Europe experimenting with that, for example? And are we seeing this cooperation either enforced or voluntary?
You know, in Europe, I was trying to see there are some North Sea agreements, but they're only sort of preliminary. They don't have necessarily contractual collaboration to the extent that I would like. So they're still sort of, as I said, you know, the UK, which is the big leader in offshore wind, they still are just using these 5-kilometer rings still. So they're not doing a whole lot in cooperation. But in the UK, you do have some legal resources to claim that there was an interest in the wind. And also in Denmark, there has been at least one case where someone was awarded damages for loss of the energy in the wind that was taken.
Well, as you point out, you know, it's important to think about these issues ex ante before you sink all of the money and the infrastructure into the turbine locations, right? Because just like Spindletop, you know, where you're putting in oil wells, wind turbines are an investment. And, you know, they have a life of, I guess, 20 to 30 years, providing they don't get too much damage from the waking and turbulence that you're talking about. So important to think about these things before installing wind farms so that we don't get, as you put it, this wild west of installation. We've covered a lot of ground today, so maybe I'll just end by asking you if there's anything else we haven't talked about that you think will be especially important going forward, either in terms of our first topic, balancing the needs and interests of developers and the grid with the interests of local landowners and other interests, or with respect to this waking issue?
I guess I'm going to say first that I've been focusing my latest resources and trying to actually lobby people in the government to think about offshore wind, because I think it has the greatest potential for having better planning and efficient development. And partly, there are a number of reasons why. I mean, first of all, the wind asset is owned collectively by the American people when we're talking about offshore. So we don't have competing landowners trying to maximize their royalties over someone else. I think we all have a stake in having the highest royalties for the American people. There's also uniformity of ownership, so you could have cooperative development and consistent federal regulation. So, you know, it makes sense. It's in its nascence. We really don't have any development of offshore wind on federal lands. Looks like not in the recent future because the Trump administration is somewhat opposed to it. But I'm hoping that means that we can think ahead and that we can maximize productivity as this new industry emerges.
We've covered a lot of ground today, so maybe I'll just end by asking you if there's anything else we haven't talked about that you think will be especially important going forward.
Although the articles we're focusing on today relate to wind development, much of my other work looks at the promise of distributed generation. Instead of continuing to build out huge industrial scale installations, I think we should turn to increased use of on-site solar storage and energy efficiency to address world energy needs. These tools have lagged behind others because they're meeting resistance from traditional energy providers like utilities. They're more challenging to manage and they don't fit into the profit motive business models. But hopefully the emergence of microgrids and their increased need in times of fires and pandemics will help elevate these energy solutions as well.
Well, thank you so much again. I appreciate it.
Welcome. Thanks so much, Sharon. This was a real pleasure.